Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking major new announcements about how universities are going to be regulated in England, a new TEF, and the use of non-disclosure agreements. It's all coming up.
Students, if we begin to move students in Ireland into the space where they feel like they are purely consumers, that they are purely consumers in a way to think that happened inside England, then we will undoubtedly get to that space, and it'll be politically irresistible to bring these kinds of regulations into place.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and here to help us set a baseline of quality for HE policy this week, we have three fabulous guests. In a very cold Oxfordshire, it's Mary Kernock-Cook, Chair of the Student Futures Commission, and other things. Mary, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, well, my highlight was the wolf moon on Monday. It was just so fantastic. And later that night, it was so bright, it felt like somebody left the spotlights on outside. It actually cast moon shadows in my house. It was really lovely. But also, we had a brilliant meeting of the Student Futures Commission on Monday this week, and we're nearly there for what I think is going to be an absolutely cracking final report to be launched at the Secret Life of Students. My commissioners are just so fab.
In a very cold Dublin, it's Ben Archibald, General Manager of the Union of Students in Ireland. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, my primary highlight of the week has to be that I have evidence that I came up with the joke that Keir Starmer used to great effect at Prime Minister's Question Time a week before he did. So there's that. The second one I have to say is we confirmed that assuming we don't have a new variant that stops everything, that our National Congress is going to go ahead in person for the first time in like 3 years. So we're happy.
And from Team Wonky, somewhere on the M5 Information Superhighway, it's David Kernahan, or DK to you and me. DK, your highlight of the week.
Well, there's a new Nepalese restaurant in the little town in Gloucestershire where I live that we never mention. I popped in last night and I ended up being interviewed by BBC Radio Gloucestershire about it. So, that'll be on Sunday night.
So we start the week with major new announcement from OFS about how it's going to regulate universities, or a consultation about how it's going to apply its regulatory powers. Mary, where do we start?
Oh, well, this has its roots in why the Office for Students, the OFS, was set up in the first place, and the Higher Education and Research Act, and principally this main B3 condition of registration. I did also reflect that perhaps it had something to do with the ruling where the Bloomsbury Institute won a case against the OFS based on them not being able to kind of enforce the B3 conditions. Anyway, the headline of the press release is OFS sets out plans to crack down on poor quality courses. This is red meat, I guess, and I hope you like it on the raw side. That said, there's of course a sort of underlying logic to what's being proposed, and it goes something like this. Why should taxpayers pick up the tab for students who are perhaps underqualified to study on courses which they then might not complete, or if they do, are not going to get them into highly enough paid jobs to be able to pay back their student loans? And then there's a sort of side dish of logic, and by the way, we shouldn't lower standards and expectations for students who come from challenging or minority backgrounds. And plus, these students would have been better off doing some technical courses that prepare them for an actual job, which the economy needs, and in brackets, and which cost less to the taxpayer. so far so good. They want universities only to admit people who are likely to succeed and pay back their loans. You might say fair enough, but of course, when we get down to how they will do this, prepare yourself for, I think it's 117 pages of gruesome detail, which for universities mostly means a new and massive data collection exercise, and of course a threat of fines or deregistration or removal of loan funding from courses that don't meet the new thresholds. When I say gruesome detail, there's data cuts proposed for full-time, part-time, undergraduate, postgraduate, by age, ethnicity, etc., 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 and all at individual course level. Gosh, what could possibly go wrong? Actually, my thoughts went immediately to the many universities that don't have modern data systems architecture in place and who will likely do this exercise via multiple spreadsheets. But actually, my biggest worry is the intersection between, well, what the sector's been doing and has been encouraged to do for years to widen participation in higher education. Basically, there's been a sort of gentleman's agreement in place where universities admit lots of students from disadvantaged backgrounds, many at lower or contextual minimum entry thresholds, and then use the diversity of their student cohorts as a justification for poorer outcomes. And that's the argument that got the Bloomsbury Institute off the hook in their legal case against the OFS. And this is what the OFS and indeed the Secretary of State want to stop. It's a kind of logic fault, isn't it, where universities have autonomy to admit whomever they want, but then don't accept responsibility for some students dropping out or failing to prosper. It's pretty hard to see how this new regime won't set back widening participation in a big way. Unless schools find a magic wand to wave over the attainment gap between rich and poor, or universities find a way to send Cinderella to the ball without leaving before midnight, I think this is going to be a big problem. Sledgehammers and nuts come to mind, but given the size of this OFS sledgehammer and the impenetrability of the particular nut, I have to say I've wondered again whether it might be easier to simply engineer some kind of university skin in the game of their own loan book. But anyway, hey ho, there we go.
Yes, well, remind us, DK, just why the idea of using outcomes to measure quality and then not benchmarking them are so controversial in the sector.
The controversial thing becomes if you have a cohort made up of students from backgrounds that are, by nature of their background, more likely not to complete their course, more likely not to move away from their home area to enter a graduate training scheme that leads to a graduate job, then you are disadvantaged in these measures, even though you might be doing the hard lifting of levelling up that the government also seems keen to see universities do. And at the heart of these consultations, and there are a number of consultations, as we'll come to, is this conflict between the idea of levelling up and the idea of quality. Now, animating political philosophy of the Boris Johnson administration has been something called cakeism, the idea that you have your cake and you also eat your cake, which is a well-known tautology, but it's something that the Prime Minister has actually said. These proposals are a little like cakeism, because on the one hand, you've got all the hard language about the proposed numerical threshold levels, and these are set in a lot of detail by the mode of study across continuation, completion, and progression. And as Mary says, you can also drill right down to individual subjects, individual groups of students, and look at their performance. But if you look at the way they're actually going to regulate, and this is something that the OFS has made clear to me, is that they will take contextual issues into account as they regulate. So even if you're not actually at one of these benchmark levels, although they're actually now calling them numerical threshold levels, it's still not a cut and dry deal that they're going to cancel that particular group of courses. This, the the second mythology in this is that they talk about this in terms of low quality courses, that students shouldn't be on low quality courses, that they don't complete, that doesn't lead to any meaningful benefit to those students if they do complete. And I think a lot of people would honestly agree with that. But the problem with that is that it assumes that we're talking about data at a course level. And as regular listeners will know, we don't get data at course level. We get data at best at a fairly high level of subject. They're talking CAR level 2. So this apparatus, it doesn't actually spot low quality courses. It spots low quality areas of provision. And I mean, this, of course, might prompt a provider to go even deeper in their own data and to look at particular courses within that area that are not performing and cut those courses proactively rather than risk having to explain themselves to the regulator. So that, in quite a large nutshell, is...
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Where the controversy lies, as I see it.
Stepping back for a bit, I mean, Ben, you don't work in the sector in England, but you're a close observer of this. Just let me put it this way. You can see probably why a lot of people in the sector here are going to be unhappy about this direction of travel. But if a student is unlikely to graduate or unlikely to get a graduate job, is it not unreasonable to do something about that?
It's completely reasonable to do something about that. And I like the point that was made earlier that this is red meat, and listeners should be obviously aware of the political situation inside the Conservative Party and the UK in general. They have been looking for something like this to, you know, right at this point. It's very convenient that it comes out this week. Students have to be protected from poor performing courses. Somebody who goes in and takes decisions as they do at 16, 17 about how they're going to structure their AAS and their A levels towards getting into higher education and what course they're going to do, they should have sufficient information to let them know whether it's going to be a particular waste of time to study a particular subject in a particular college. Nobody's going to fundamentally disagree with that. But the problem, I suppose, is where we have pared down the higher education sector into being a purely economic driver, and then completely ignoring the initial basis of the university and the initial basis of the kind of holistic and generalized learning, that people should be able to study the thing that really motivates them, because they themselves may elevate that learning through their own activity. If this results in a college looking at a particular area of study and saying, oh, that's going to make us look terrible, let's dump it, and then that happens across whole sectors of learning, then the widening participation agenda disappears, and the broadening of the kind of the cultural and social value of the college begins to end. So I think, from an Irish perspective, with knowledge of the UK system, I think this is a dangerous, potentially dangerous approach, but nobody's going to disagree with the idea of students being protected from consistently failing courses.
I was speaking to someone yesterday who's delivering what you might call a sort of boot camp plus in the creative tech sector. And she was telling me that she has a lot of people signing up for a program, which, by the way, costs about £9,000 for a 6-9 month course and paid for through an income sharing arrangement. And she said that they had quite a few people coming on who are graduates from creative tech courses, stuff like gaming and so on. And she would hear from these people who said they'd gone to job interviews and had frankly been embarrassed by how little they knew and were coming on this course because they wanted to get job ready. And, you know, if what's being proposed fixes some of that, then of course it's a good thing. I think I'm more concerned about how they're going to do this. I just see, you know, huge numbers of data cuts, a lot of data cells with very small numbers in, which will be statistically dodgy. I wonder how, in the context of the OFS, I think it's promised to cut 10% of its costs, and I just wonder how on earth they're going to have the capacity to undertake what feels like such an enormous exercise. And I also worry about, you know, just unintended consequences. You know, if you have to correct a fault in the system, which, as Ben says, I think is there, albeit in small pockets, we hope. But if you have to crack it with such an enormous exercise, I think the opportunity for unintended consequences is just huge. And I feel comfortable about the aim of this, but I don't feel at all comfortable with the how it's going to be done bit of it.
Yeah, and Andy West was saying on Twitter this morning, we're going to need a bigger regulator.
It does feel that way. The other thing that we need to remember here is that this direct use of data in higher education regulation, more so than ever before, it makes the definition of data a very highly politicized activity. A lot of the policy action in this set of consultations is in a delight called the Consultation on Constructing Student Outcome and Experience Indicators, which is 195 pages. It's roughly as dry as it sounds. But you get into the definition of, okay, we're looking for graduates to have a positive destination. What is defined as a positive destination? And you learn in there that a positive destination includes any kind of further study. It doesn't matter what the level. So even if you're going into, as Mary talks about, a training course that picks up on the deficiencies of your undergraduate course, then that is counted as a positive destination. There's lots of other odd wrinkles in the stuff around continuation. There's two different methods of calculating continuation. I mean, not only one of them that's based on actual continuation across a single cohort. But the big worry here is that the Office of Students has performed something of a land grab. It's taken on a lot of this definition work for the data that will underpin its regulation itself, rather than letting the existing mechanisms via HESA and across the four nations of the UK work properly. So there is a sense here in which the Office for Students is changing quite radically the available data in order to make its system of regulation work, rather than changing its system of regulation to fit the data that is actually reasonably available. And for smaller providers, for providers that might also provide FE qualifications and return data via a completely different and much more onerous system, this just adds substantially to the burden. And it's these same people that are looking at the increase in their work through the increase in this burden who are currently dealing with the slow and uncertain implementation of the Data Futures Programme and are looking down the barrel at the lifelong loan entitlement and the fact all of this will have to be changed again to deal with modular provision. These are the people that have the skills to respond to this 195-page consultation. And I just don't know what kind of meaningful response to this incredibly complicated use of data definitions to create policy the Office for Students are expecting to get.
I mean, there's a lot of material here on numbers, as you say, DK, an enormous kind of piece of work to respond to it. But I mean, Mary, not a single word at all about why some students might drop out or not get a decent job. I mean, have we just completely lost the plot here? Has this approach of basically just counting everything but not developing any understanding about how to change things just made us all lose sight about what the purpose of regulation is? I mean, and if you're right, you know, is this the tipping point for the sector to declare independence?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. But, you know, don't forget, I think the threshold for full-time undergraduate meaningful employment, or whatever they call it, is meaningful destinations is 60%. And so you'd think, well, allowing 40% of them to not want to get a job or have a baby or, you know, whatever the reasons are that people might not be doing that, to me seems not unreasonable. But actually talking about destinations, you know, I was thinking of a couple of things. I think apprenticeships are degree apprenticeships are included as a cut in all of this. And you're thinking, well, hang on, if somebody drops out of an apprenticeship, you know, a main reason they might do that is they got fired from the job because it's actually an employment contract that they've undertaken, or that, you know, the employer goes bust or something. So, you know, how do you account for in apprenticeships when it's something at the employment contract between the student and the employer? And also, I wondered whether you need a sort of RPI type index for graduate employment. You know, if you think back to the financial crash 2008-09, when graduate employment fell off a cliff, or indeed, you know, the disruption that we've had through the pandemic, you know, they're going to have to deploy some kind of indexation of graduate employment based on the availability of jobs and, you know, the level of unemployment, etc., etc. So, you know, I'm just wondering if this is just escalating into something, you know, the more data you collect, the more you need to make it meaningful, and then the whole thing just spirals completely out of control. But don't get me wrong, I think the underlying aim of this, you know, has got a logic that is appealing and is right. I just think that this massive data exercise is, I don't know, it seems destined to go quite badly wrong. And by the way, I think DK's points about, well, how's OFS going to do this, and why isn't HESA doing it? And so, you know, I think that's all interesting and worrying.
Ben, while we've got you, because you know, you made a good case for the kind of political political case for doing this in the round.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season but not sure how? Go to gofundme.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
But I'm interested to know whether, you know, it's this line of thinking is essentially, this way of approaching regulation is kind of inevitable. I mean, you've got HG legislation being proposed in Ireland right now. Could all this result in your own HG authority doing something like this?
I don't suspect that it will. The institutions here, every institution everywhere, of course, seeks to robustly assert its independence and its autonomy. In Ireland, that is that goes to the nth. For instance, I remember a time whenever I sat on the Higher Education Authority, and a senior staff member was superannuated by about 3 years. We pointed out this was unlawful, but that the college had the autonomy, if it wished to continue to break the law. These things, this was a long time ago, I'm safe, don't worry. Nobody's going to get sued for that. But there is an argument in Ireland as well about, well, listen, what's the value of my course? Obviously, here it's cheaper to study. 3,000 euros is the cost of the free fees, registration fee for students per year. So it's a good bit cheaper than over there. But students, if we begin to move students in Ireland into the space where they feel like they are purely consumers, that they are purely consumers in a way, the thing that happened inside England, then we will undoubtedly get to that space, and it'll be politically irresistible to bring these kinds of regulations into place.
So to get into any of the detail we've discussed about this topic, please go to wonky.com. We've got a whole range of articles from the team, and lots of commentary from the sector coming over the coming days, and lots of the detail to unravel over there. Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name's Alex Blower, Access and Participation Manager for Arts University Bournemouth, and this week I have been writing for Wonky on the appointment of the new Director for Fair Access for the Office for Students, John Blake, the letter by Michelle Donnellan providing a steer on what the government believe access and participation work and policy should consist of, and discuss whether it's good, whether it's bad, or whether it's just a little bit ugly and confusing at the moment. I also provide quite a definitive answer from my own institutional perspective as creative higher education providers as whether or not we should be engaging in activities such as maths and English tutoring to raise attainment. So give it a read.
Hi, my name's Jonathan Grant and I run a small consultancy called Different Angles. This week on Wonky, I published a blog examining whether universities are civic washing. To do this, I examined the gap between the rhetoric around civic engagement and what universities do in practice by looking at the 59 universities that had committed to developing a civic university agreement in 2019 and seeing whether they were paying a living wage to their lowest paid staff, largely cleaners and security staff. I found that there was a significant minority of these universities were not paying a living wage and were not accredited with the Living Wage Foundation, despite saying that they were civic institutions. I conclude by arguing that it is inexcusable that some universities claim to be civic, but are unwilling to support their local communities and paying a living wage. As I've argued in the New Power University, the local impact of universities occurs through the way they operate, as well as through their education and research missions.
Now the TEF is back. It lives, DK.
It lives, although it now returns to its original name of the Teaching Excellence Framework. It's no longer called the Teaching Excellence and Student Outcomes Framework. So
outcomes are being done by another branch of FS, as we've discussed.
Well, the outcomes are still in the framework. It's just not called that. So that was a little bit of a nerdy point to start on. But for those just coming up to speed, the Teaching Excellence Framework was originally proposed in the 2015 Conservative Manifesto, which was written by Joe Johnson. He then became Higher Education Minister, implemented it via a series of green and white papers, and it became the main point of discussion in Parliament during the passage of the Higher Education and Research Act. In essence, it's a way of rating the provision of universities at either a bronze, silver, or gold level, all of which levels are above the baseline. And in the past, it did this via looking at a range of benchmarked metrics, which means metrics that are compensated to take account of the makeup of a student body at a particular provider. As time progressed, these were tweaked. There was the abortive trial of a subject level TEF, which was dropped because it was ridiculously bureaucratic. And then the last time the TEF ran was in 2019, because future iterations were waiting for the release of the Pearce review of TEF, which you'll remember happened in January of 2021. The Pearce review recommended a number of changes, particularly removing the emphasis on indicators above everything else and paying a lot more accord to the provider's own understanding and interpretation of the quality of its teaching. And in this new message, you'll see equal weighting given to metrics drawn from the National Student Survey and from the continuation and other outputs data, and also from a statement taken a statement provided by the university in question, and also an optional submission from university students that would probably use the normal student representation mechanisms in that provider. It's a big change. It puts TEF back on the agenda after a number of people, myself included, feeling that it might be gently dropped because nobody really cares about it. It's still there, it's still happening, and it is a teaching excellence framework once more.
The thing that caught my eye was that while we've still got bronze, silver and gold, there's a new grade called requires improvement. And I remember when that requires improvement grade came in for the Ofsted judgments, and I thought that was quite a good thing, actually. And, you know, in the previous TEF, you either didn't get a TEF rating at all, or you were bronze, silver and gold. And actually, I think requires improvement will put a bit of grit in this oyster. I think it's a good thing if it starts to help put teaching excellence on a par with research excellence in the kind of institutional DNA.
Isn't the part of the idea of a TEF, though, to kind of explain to students what, you know, help students make choices about where to go? I mean, what's your view about this, Mary? Does it help?
Well, my feeling was that it never really had any cut through at the kind of student choice level, and that's partly it's partly because it was only going for a couple of well, I think there was only one exercise, one rating exercise that was ever done. So I think if it embeds and starts being a thing that everybody does look for, then yeah, that probably is a good thing for students. I seem to remember that the original TEF was initially sort of almost like a self-diagnostic exercise, wasn't it? And attached to potential tuition fee increases. As far as I understand it, that's no longer, there's nothing to do with tuition fee increases in this, is there?
There's not, but the consultation does make clear that possibility still exists in regulation. So it could potentially happen in the future, although if we think about the potential oncoming Augar review and all of the other bits of machinery that are floating about higher education at the moment, it does feel unlikely.
Ben, what's your view? What's your view of the TEF from another system?
So we in Ireland we've adopted a. There was a forum, national forum for the enhancement of teaching and learning, and we developed our national student engagement program alongside that to ensure that students and students' views of how well they were taught and students' views on particularly excellent practice inside higher education would result then in awards internally in order to encourage the sector to take advantage of good and best practice. There hasn't been this kind of this traffic light approach here. I think broadly, if you're going back to the point that I made a little earlier, if students are provided with good, students whenever they're in secondary school level are provided with good information about where it's likely that they're going to be taught well, then that's going to give them an idea about what where they want to go, and it'll give them an opportunity to choose what's best for them. That having been said, the idea of needs improvement, I think if I'm studying in a particular college and the course comes under assessment and it's anywhere other than gold, then I'm going to think that needs improvement. And I think that everybody will kind of look, if it's properly advertised and if it's properly then relied upon in the literature that the colleges develop inside their prospectuses, then it stands a good chance of actually being a good thing for improving improving teaching and improving the concentration that the college has on teaching. That having been said, whenever if there's been kind of one exercise carried out and then we had COVID, I think that anybody who relied on that for their choice of college and now has been kind of studying at home for the last 2 years, it'll leave a rather bitter taste in their mouth. I think this speaks though to a basic logic of collecting data and being prepared to present the data, but then not showing people or not providing fora for people to actually improve. It's essentially useless to tell somebody, well, the teaching in this location isn't particularly good. We're still going to continue to fund them. There should be some method. There should be some, it doesn't necessarily need to be centralized, but inside topic areas, some development of skills and methods to encourage and support lecturers and teachers to become better. Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, we're going to get into all of these issues a lot more at next month's Secret Life of Students, our event all about the student experience and rethinking it. And my colleague and co-host, Jim, is here to tell us a bit more about that.
It's Jim from the team here, and very excited to say that in February, our event, The Secret Life of Students, is back. Now in its third year, it's all about how we rethink the student experience, bringing together experts, sector leaders and professionals, as well as student leaders and student union managers to tackle difficult challenges and work together to transform higher education to better meet the needs of the next generation of students. This year, we're doing diversity differently, rethinking the outdated model of designing learning environments based on an imagined normal student, and then applying sticking plaster interventions based on diverse student characteristics. We'll reflect on the findings of the UPP Foundation's Student Futures Commission. We'll consider developments in regulatory regimes for access, diversity and equality. We'll have a wealth of new insight to share from our own research with students and higher education professionals and leaders. And we'll think through how engaging with students' lived experience can transform strategy, policy and delivery, and we'll consider what students are experiencing and saying about harassment and discrimination and where the boundaries are between security and freedom. All of that, lots more. The Secret Life of Students, London, February the 15th. To find out more and book tickets, go right now to wonky.com/events.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? And here to set this week's correlation question live is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate, the podcast segment that's waiting for the publication of Sue Gray's report before coming to any firm conclusions. This week's question is deceptively simple. Do providers that get more of their funding from research activity employ more of their academic staff on research-only contracts? So we're looking at the proportion of institutional funding that comes from research activity and the proportion of academic staff that are on research-only contracts. Does it correlate?
Oh, to be honest, I haven't got a clue, and I'm just trying to guess whether the answer is as you would expect it to be or whether it's one of those ones where that's too obvious and it's the other way around. So I will vote for yes, it does correlate.
Well, I'm going to come in as a complete guess as well here. I don't think, from my experience of higher education in the UK, I don't think that any sensible policy will naturally take hold organically. So let's say it doesn't.
That's entirely impeccable logic, Ben. It's also wrong. Interestingly, the answer is yes. R squared is 0.78. So that's a very strong correlation. Indeed so, yes. Data is from the last complete year of provider releases from HESA, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
And finally, Universities Minister Michelle Donnan has called for the end of use of non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment cases. Ben, talk us through it.
So yes, this was a report from earlier in the week, a letter written by the minister to VCs, asking them to sign up to a pledge that in cases of sexual misconduct, bullying and other forms of harassment, that they would no longer, or that they would not use NDAs in order to silence victims and survivors of those. There was a lot of media coverage on this, and it has played, I think, very, very well for the minister. And I think that whenever we had a conversation with it inside USI here, it sparked a lot of conversation. And in fact, there have been similar things in Ireland. I look forward to talking about those in a few minutes.
So this is one of these interventions, isn't it, where I think most people can agree that it looks very bad for universities, and it kind of is very bad on a moral level. And it seems to me, Mary, maybe there's been a kind of disconnect between kind of decisions that universities have taken over the years, and you can sort of imagine legal departments pushing these things through, and it not ever having been discussed at a senior level about kind of the institutional policy about this, and then before we know it, it started a much wider debate. Is it right then for the minister to get involved with this?
Yeah, I think this is a really important area. You know, not least because sexual misconduct, bullying, and so on is so much in the kind of public consciousness, rightly, at the moment. I think my impression is that NDAs, where they're used, are very often used to hide not so much the outcomes or the incidents, but really poor process in universities. You know, I get the impression that universities probably haven't put enough effort into doing their investigations and the work they need to do when a complaint's made really well, so that victims are protected and heard, that perpetrators are dealt with, and also that they're done quickly. You know, you hear of these cases that drag on for months and even years, and often handled by people who probably haven't got adequate knowledge and training, you know, that might end up in the kind of HR department or something. So amongst other things, I think if this improves how universities design and execute their processes around these kind of complaints, you know, particularly sexual harassment and violence and so on, and I think it's to be welcomed. That said, you know, it's never a good look for the sector, is it, when the minister has to tell us to get on with doing something that we should have been doing anyway.
Yeah. Indeed. Ben, you hinted at the approach in Ireland. Talk us through that.
Yeah, just before I do that, though, I think the most common response to this has been, whenever it's been discussed, is just how vile the idea is, that somebody who has been subjected to bullying, harassment, sexual harassment, but in some cases sexual assault, and then has that offence compounded by being told that they're not allowed to talk about it, and they're not allowed to talk about their experience of the investigation, they're not allowed to talk about their experience of the processes that existed, and I think that it's one of these things, as was said, the legal departments will have kind of done this as a pro forma, this is what we now have to do. And nobody's given any thought to, well, listen, is this a humane, is this a logical, is this an ethically sustainable approach to take whenever somebody has actually submitted a complaint that will have been painful for them to submit themselves? So we looked into this inside here, and I suppose anybody that I spoke to, that their first response was, really? People have actually done that? They've actually used NDAs? Well, actually, in Ireland, a senator, member of Anshanad Éireann, who used to be, not so long ago, the president of Trinity College Dublin Students' Union, submitted a question because she had been made aware of, or she says that she's been made aware of, NDAs being used in Ireland. The response from that was very, very quick. The minister for the sector simply wrote to all the colleges and asked them, are you doing this? With the clear understanding that if you're doing this, stop it. They all came back and said, no, of course we don't do that. But the senator in question says that doesn't correlate with the information that she has from students students and staff who have experienced these things. And of course, that comes to the heart of the NDA, isn't it? One of the interesting things about the NDA is you're not supposed to discuss the fact that you've got an NDA. So it's going to take some time for these cases on both sides of the Irish Sea to kind of emerge and for people to understand exactly where are the campuses where NDAs have been used, and has therefore a false picture of how safe it is to study on a particular campus been painted? Because if some places have experienced significant numbers of cases and have used significant numbers of NDAs, students have deserved to know that it was a potentially unsafe place to study. Now, obviously, this will be a tiny number of places, we would hope, but it's still chilling to think of.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in the UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Mary, Ben, DK and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. Until next week, stay wonky.